This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, January 27th, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. On this edition of Ozarks, a trip deep into the Buffalo River wilderness to William McNamara's studio. Plus, the Artist Coalition Artemis mixes metal and vinyl. And in just a moment, how some area colleges and universities use advertising to promote their campuses.
KUAF is supported by AY Magazine, About You, offering information about style, life, money, well-being, and more, including cooking and gardening videos. A restaurant guide is available as well as information about places to live. More information, including the AY About You app, is available at aymag.com.
Every day, we're subjected to hundreds, even thousands of advertisements. J. Walker Smith, the president of the high-profile marketing firm Yankovich, estimates as many as 5,000 ads a day in front of our eyes, from razors to sodas to blockbuster movies. And colleges. Institutions of higher learning need to get their name and message to people, too.
As Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas reports, universities in the region use billboards, TV, and other media to heighten their profile.
Driving along I-540, a billboard can be seen for Pittsburgh State University. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania? No. Pittsburgh, Kansas. The Pittsburgh without an H. While it is a bit closer than Pennsylvania, it still raises the question, why? Why is a university in Kansas advertising in Northwest Arkansas?
It's only 90 minutes away, which is really surprising to people.
That's Chris Kelly, Associate Vice President for Marketing and Communications with Pittsburgh State University.
Our location, we are right basically on the borders of Missouri and Oklahoma. In fact, if you drive 10 minutes, you're in the state of Missouri. Go south 20, 25 minutes, you're in Oklahoma. So several years ago, we looked at the location, and our Board of Regents here in the state said, you know, it really does make sense, because of your location, to begin looking at offering in-state tuition to contiguous counties in Missouri and Oklahoma. And we've done that for many, many years.
And last year, Pittsburgh State extended the same opportunity into Benton and Washington counties in Northwest Arkansas.
Because really, you're as close as many of the other counties, and it just makes sense. So we call it the Gorilla Advantage, offering the in-state tuition for students who qualify. So once we began to do that, we looked down into Northwest Arkansas. It's such a dynamic and exciting area that we wanted to make students and parents aware of the opportunity that they have here.
It's called the Gorilla Advantage, as Pittsburgh State's mascot is the gorilla. The university also has a lot of alumni in Northwest Arkansas. Former Walmart president and CEO Lee Scott was a Pitt State gorilla. Billboards. Anyone who drives or rides along state highways sees them. Arkansas State University in Jonesboro also uses billboards. With 14,000 students on its campus, it is almost twice the size of Pittsburgh State. Christy Valentine, Executive Director of University Communications for ASU, is also very strategic and intentional with the placement of ASU's billboards.
We look at traffic patterns, we look at drive times, we look at, you know, I always try to make sure where the billboards are placed, they're in highly visible locations. I never buy a board where there's another one under it, like a double board, unless I can have both, because I'm afraid of the message of the board that might be underneath it. So we have a list of targeted high schools in the state whose student population meets that admission standard. So that also helps guide me in terms of where I want to place my advertising. Very strategic. It's not, oh, I like that spot and we're going to put one there. We consider lots of factors before we make decisions like that.
Ms. Valentine is relatively new to her position, having held it for just over 1 year. Before she took over, she says that the university did not have just one message it was trying to get across. Rather, each college and department was sending out whatever it deemed important. Ms. Valentine says that she has taken great effort to come up with a cohesive message for the entire university and has been successful, something that was evident with changing just a few of those previously mentioned billboards.
We had billboards all over the state that the colleges had put up themselves, and they were great, but they were wordy, and they conveyed different messages. You might or might not know that they were an Arkansas State University billboard. We pulled all of those boards down, and now everything you see, and we have very few, we were very selective with what we put up. Every billboard looks the same in terms of color, in terms of style, in terms of message. So when we did that, people thought we increased our advertising. And actually what we did is we pulled down six or seven boards, and now we only have five.
Though ASU had cut their advertising in half, people thought they had increased because their message was so powerful. And as for that message,
my university offers opportunities both inside and outside the classroom. Arkansas State University, a great place to call mine.
Ms. Valentine calls this the My University campaign. She says that when speaking with students, faculty, and alumni, one of the things they value about ASU is a sense of belonging, something she is trying to embrace and promote in marketing efforts. The University of Arkansas, located in the opposite corner of the state from ASU, and almost twice the size with over 20,000 students, also uses a campus-wide campaign.
University of Arkansas, the U of A.
That's Y-O-U of A, a slogan that John Diamond, Associate Vice Chancellor for University Relations, says emphasizes the student-centeredness of the U of A.
The university is unique, and even though you could look, it's easy to say the U of A, meaning the letter U of A, for short for University of Arkansas, reminding people, whether they're students, faculty, or staff, that we are all about you, the student, is an important part of our mission.
As the flagship land-grant university for the state of Arkansas, the mission of the U of A is not only student-focused, but also to get engaged in research and outreach in order to serve the state and the nation.
Our role in terms of marketing is more to engage people and to make them aware of what we can do for them, whether they're prospective students or whether they're in business or they're entrepreneurs or they're farming or ranching. There are private schools and for-profit schools and some public schools that market because they're trying to increase their enrollment and develop as an institution. Our purpose is different. I'm not passing judgment on them, but our purpose is different because we already have we have that level of awareness established. What we need to do is make sure people know what we can do for them and what we're not able to do for them.
Furthering the U of A's desire to raise awareness to the university, both nationally and internationally, a video played on a screen in Times Square for 3 months last year. The 30-second video did not have sound, but it did showcase well-known imagery of the U of A.
Our research has shown that the Razorback is one of the images of the university, or our mascot's name is nationally recognized, so we played off that, not in terms of bragging about sports, but just bragging about Arkansas Razorbacks.
Mr. Diamond did bring up an important point, bragging about sports. One thing these very dissimilar schools do have in common is athletics. All three had a monumentous 2011 year in terms of football. The University of Arkansas made it to top three in the nation, and the Pittsburgh State Gorillas are the Division II national champions. Chris Kelly with Pittsburgh State says this excitement is fueling the awareness, but he does want to make this message clear.
You'll see billboards in the area, and you'll probably see one down in that area before long, letting people know that, you know, not only were we champions on the field, but academics is important to us. We're champions in the classroom as well. In Division II, it really is, the student really is there before student-athlete. So we're very proud of our academic offerings as well. And when you win a national championship, obviously that brings a little more attention to you on a national scale when you're able to be on ESPN and get a national audience. That's very important for us, and we want people to know now when we may have a higher level of interest from students out there exactly what they can expect if they choose to attend Pittsburgh State and become a Gorilla.
And over in Jonesboro, at Arkansas State University, Gus Malzahn was hired to be the head coach of the Red Wolves. Christy Valentine says that not only will it influence how they market the athletics program, but also how they market the university as a whole.
We are going to tie the Malzahn in with we had a very successful football season this year. We ended 10-2. We were Sun Belt Conference champions. We went to a bowl, the GoDaddy.com Bowl in Mobile, Alabama. So we had a very successful year, one of the most successful in history. We're going to tie that team and this coach together with successful programs that we have across campus, and we're going to push it as a package. I'm anxious to see how that pays off for us. I see that as a positive.
Three schools, three missions, three messages. all trying to raise awareness of their institution. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
And before we move ahead with this edition of Ozarks at Large, I'm Goodwin Strauss, math professor.
Howdy.
Howdy. You had a quiz last week.
Right.
You're going to have an answer today.
I sure am.
Before we talk about that in 20 minutes or so.
Yeah, get a couple of coins, get a piece of paper, and actually, if you really feel like getting ahead, make a row of 8 little boxes on the piece of paper.
Get a piece of paper, get a writing utensil, make a long rectangle, divide it into 8 pieces, get 2 coins.
Right.
It'll make all of our time together so much more special.
It will.
That's coming up in about 20 minutes or so. Thanks, Haim.
Earth, sky.
A chemical compound in a moss used in Chinese medicine for thousands of years might be an effective new treatment for Alzheimer's disease. A team of scientists, led by Yale chemist Seth Herzon, have synthesized this moss compound in the lab. Dr. Herzon said the compound inhibits an enzyme called acetylcholine esterase that's been linked to Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Herzon explains.
Basically, what's most commonly prescribed for Alzheimer's are other acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, but they don't really stop the disease. They're kind of like taking Tylenol to relieve a headache. It takes care of the symptoms, but it doesn't stop the progression of Alzheimer's.
But Herzon told us that the compound in the moss might actually be able to arrest the progress of Alzheimer's.
So now we're going to be able to ask those questions and find out if that truly is the case.
Until now, Herzon added, scientists haven't been able to easily synthesize this compound in the lab without lots of time and lots of money. But his team, through new methods of chemistry, figured out how to do this in just a few steps at potentially low cost.
So having a synthetic route, like the one that we've developed, enables you to sort of sidestep that issue. Now we can make it in the lab. We don't need to go out and collect moss.
For more, come to our website and search for Chinese moss. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Watercolorist William McNamara creates shimmering Ozark landscapes in his remote cabin on the Upper Buffalo Wilderness. Ozark's at largest Jacqueline Froelich found him there this winter, maple sugaring.
Bill McNamara, along with Abby, a catahoula, and Sam, a lab mix, crush through the woods towards a grove of native sugar maples he's tapped.
And I'll just walk along with my 5-gallon bucket and empty them in there and fill it up and take it home and boil it down.
Sounds easy, but it takes days to boil down 5 gallons of maple sap into 1 pint of thick amber syrup. But Bill McNamara, a tall and broad, good-looking, silver-haired fellow, is a very patient guy.
It started flowing fast. You see how it's all the way up?
The plastic jug affixed to the maple trees brimming with sap. Bill McNamara knows every tree species on this mountain, tracing back to when he fell in love with the Arkansas Ozarks in the spring of 1974.
And everything was in bloom, and the water was everywhere, and it was beautiful. And a hawk followed us led us up the hill, and it was sort of magic.
Raised in rural Louisiana, Bill and his former spouse, Melancy, she lives here as well, and she's from New Orleans, were both teachers, and they moved to the Ozarks to homestead 80 acres on Cave Mountain with a friend. The property's completely remote, just down the road from Hawksbill Crag, one of the most photographed views on the Buffalo River. The marriage dissolved 15 years ago, but the relationship, like the maple syrup, has simmered into a mellow friendship and productive business partnership. Bill lives in the family's original cabin across the road, and Melancy's in the main house, a beauty of a place, hand-built out of rough-cut oak with hand-hewn beams.
Well, I cut them out of an old cherry tree that had fallen over on the field line.
The couple also grew and put up much of their own food, had a milk cow chickens, and raised 3 sons, Patrick, John, and Christopher. Before settling here, Bill taught college art in Louisiana, even moved to Europe for a while. But this is home.
My land borders the Upper Buffalo Wilderness, which a lot of my paintings come from, and I just like to be able to wander out in the woods.
On occasion, bringing his pencils, paints, and papers, resulting in what his friend, the late author and art historian Donald Harrington, describes as magical realism. Bill McNamara has spent decades capturing ancient Ozarks wilderness by now. Trees and karst, clad in moss and lichen, coursing with sparkling spring water. But he sees things differently from the rest of us.
Well, I think of it more as patterns and all, but I use the natural landscape to kind of develop my patterns.
Layers and layers of brush-painted transparent marks that define the surface, depth, and weight of a place, as well as its atmosphere. But McNamara says he started out as an abstract painter.
But in 1970, we were traveling, and I stopped beside this river in Idaho. And at the time, I was a little bit getting into Oriental art and philosophy. And they were, at the time, Western art was, there were so many words involved in describing what you were doing and all this. And I was trying to get just to the point of reacting and without, and just seeing what would come out. And I was doing watercolors at the time, but I thought you had to do them in a couple hours. And I sat down beside that river and worked for, I don't know, 8 or 9 hours, though I'd, you know, taken breaks. And that was sort of the beginning of this.
This meaning the pursuit of what he now calls abstract realism, which up close appear as small points, swirls, and lines of color, but from a distance merge into a luminous, almost photographic whole.
And I don't know, I like the chaotic look of it's an abstract thing up close to mess. And about two-thirds of the way through a painting or somewhere in there, I do away with any subject matter, and it's just me looking at the painting. And it's a mystery to me sort of where the criteria comes to pick what I'm doing. It's just a thought, you're just looking and reacting.
Much like traditional Chinese artists, he intentionally blends brush strokes with negative white space. The piece Upper Pool, for example, is of a cove, autumnal leaves floating upon milky turquoise water. Seven fish reveals placid minnows stationary against a clear, cold current along a stony creek bottom. Spring Run is of a gushing tributary, illuminated in April's halcyon light. His paintings of drenched red amaryllis blooms on fat green stalks, white bloodroot blossoms, and yellow crocus emerging from winter leaf duff reveal astonishing accuracy.
You know, I get good comments from geologists because they can name the rocks, tell me what kind of rocks they are.
And McNamara wilderness snowscapes capture that incredible frigid blue light only present in silent deep winter. He says he may spend up to 8 hours a day painting.
It's a dance between putting in enough time to get it done and not putting in so much you burn yourself out over years and years of doing the same. And so luckily I don't feel comfortable if I don't paint enough. So I don't know, it's a habit I've gotten into, like some kind of drug, and you have to maintain it.
Bill McNamara mixes his own primary colors on an enamel palette rather than using pre-mixed paints. So he takes Windsor Newton Thalo Blue, Cadmium Yellow, Windsor Red, and Sepia Brown pigments and paints them on Arch's 300-pound watercolor paper. The works are large and take months to complete.
One of the artists that he always admired was Vermeer.
That's Melancy McNamara, and she's referring to Johannes Vermeer, a 17th-century Dutch painter famous for his exquisite portraits, most notably The Girl with a Pearl Earring. Perhaps you've heard of it? Melancy oversees the framing and marketing of Bill McNamara's work.
Billy has an unlisted number because he's a very private person and because I'm a detail person. And so I enjoy this. And I feel like his work promotes itself if only I can make it available for people who have never seen it. And that's how I see my role. And then I'm the record keeper because I'm really a detail person. So I have a chronology of all his paintings and slides. I keep all buyers. I know everybody who's ever bought a print. I like that. I like to know that. I like to be a facilitator is how I see my role.
And the cataloging of McNamara is critical at this juncture because it will fetch a great deal of attention down the road off Cave Mountain. Original McNamaras are held by several museums as well as private collectors across the country, including well-known patrons. His offset and giclée prints are widely purchased. He does not exhibit in galleries. But Bill McNamara is feeling fertile these days, despite his age, 65, working on an ambitious 16-piece large watercolor national traveling exhibition. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more, visit McNamaraWatercolors.com.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this week, and we are paying tribute to Etta James. We lost Etta James on January 20th, so we're going to celebrate her life. We also have music from the Fabulous High Tops, Cedric Burnside and Lightning Malcolm, Marquise Knox, Roy Roberts, Eric Bibb, Big James and the Chicago Playboys, Contino, and a few others. And that's the Generic Blue Show, every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
It's Friday, January 27th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And joining us inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Bacon-Martin, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Do you know why Spam is funny?
Because it comes in a can?
Because it has a lot of salt?
For that. No, it's not funny for that. You know why Spam is hilarious. Spam-a-lot.
Oh.
Yes. You know this.
Yes.
And you know what the line comes from about we eat ham and jam and Spam a lot. Mm-hmm.
It's from Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail.
Right.
Oh.
So the touring musical is coming to Fort Smith on Monday.
One night only.
One night only. And we're going to have a little Spam a lot by the numbers segment.
Okay.
According to their website, among the props is a cow that weighs 45 pounds.
Yes.
It takes two stage hands to catapult it over the castle.
Have you seen the movie by any chance, Antoinette? Okay, so you know why a cow gets catapulted.
Making the sound of a horse takes 40 coconuts a month.
So they wear through them.
Yes.
That's funny.
The set utilizes 35 line sets, 30 chain motors, and more than 13,000 pounds of stage weight.
Ugh. Now, you know, when you hear that, and like, sometimes Spam-a-lot will come to a place and be there for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel sorry for the people who set it up. But the one day, I mean, you
for
set it up.
Day. Well,
and
they
then
hire locals to come in.
Oh, good.
In. Yeah.
Good. Okay.
They hire, I forget the number, but they hire a crew of
good.
Locals
okay.
to come in. The Grail lift that elevates the Lady of the Lake weighs more than 4,000 pounds and uses 2,600 pounds of hydraulic pressure.
And if you ever wonder why a ticket might cost what it does, here's
you're
one reason.
Mm-hmm. 6 pounds of confetti every night.
Spectacle does not come inexpensively.
100 wigs, 3 feet of blood that they have to iron.
You iron it?
Don't ask me. I've never used that kind of stage blood.
That's awesome.
And oh, by the way, they have more than 100 undergarments in the show, including 30 pairs of men's fishnets and 56 cod pieces.
Wait, how are men's fishnets any different from women's fishnets?
They've got to be bigger.
Oh.
Men are taller.
Fine.
I assume.
Mm.
I guess the same way you'd say a men's jacket versus a woman's jacket.
Okay.
And yeah. 56 cod pieces.
We heard.
Just wanted to make that point.
Yes.
All right. They're coming to the Fort Smith Convention Center, 7:30 Monday, one show only. Tickets are $32 to $35 at 788-7300. Also this weekend, A Conversation of Books with Bill Harrison.
Yes.
Author of the new Black August. That's 6 o'clock tonight at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville. Could this be any further from that? Tonight is the release party for a new album called The Hills Have Amps.
Right. It's metal. It's on vinyl. It's part of Artemis.
It is. And it's Vore performing tonight with Potions and Lightbulb Detective Agency. This all starts at 9 o'clock at Smoke and Barrel, and tickets are $10.
Conversation with one of the people behind that later in this show.
Mm-hmm.
And on Saturday, No Time for Sergeants. Again, can we leap to a more diametrically opposed position? Part of the Rogers Historical Museum's Media Images of the South film series at 1 o'clock at the Rogers Public Library. It is free.
First time Don Knotts and Andy Griffith worked together.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I knew he'd know that. There's also a family bike ride with the Bicycle Coalition of the Ozarks. It starts at Bike City Cyclery at 2 o'clock on Saturday and winds up at the Omni Center.
Mm-hmm.
There's a book talk with Jeannie Wayne.
Yes.
Fascinating book.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Have you read it from cover to cover yet?
No, I have not.
Kyle was pretty excited. I haven't read it.
It's really, really, really interesting.
I know you had a story. We've got a story in What's Up Today. Mm-hmm. It really is interesting. Don't let the rest of the title, The Transformation of Agriculture in the New South, don't let that scare you off.
It's nonfiction, yes, but it's so well researched, and the stories and the side stories, mm-hmm. just the few pages she spends explaining the yellow fever outbreak of Memphis and how that town transformed in a matter of days.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating, fascinating read.
She speaks at 4 o'clock on Saturday at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville. And Lewis Black is in town Saturday night. Just in case you wondered what all those cars were at the Walton Arts Center, showtime's 8 o'clock and it's sold out.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
And Jody Beznoska wanted me to just remind people it's probably an R-rated show.
You think?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there a wait list, I suppose?
I think it's always worth
checking. Show up. And if you don't get it, then you can go across and do something else on Dixon Street. But you never know.
Well, if it's rated R, maybe I can hope for somebody to walk out partway through and I'll take the
and take
in.
A seat.
Yeah, okay.
You can try. Let me know how that turns out.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor for Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
KUAF is supported by Ella's Restaurant, located at the Inn at Carnell Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. Ella's offers a variety of fine dining experiences during breakfast, lunch, dinner, and weekend brunch. An Indian lunch buffet is served each Tuesday. Menus, event schedules, and more information available at ellasrestaurant.com.
Tonight on Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsberg, Robert will talk with the reigning king of the Hammond B3 organ, Joey DeFrancesco. DeFrancesco describes his life in music, growing up in the jazz mecca of Philadelphia, and his upcoming performance in Fayetteville at the Legacy Blues Club. Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsberg tonight, beginning at 10 on KUAF.
Earlier this week, the UARC Bowl in Fayetteville announced it will host comedian Carlos Mencia March 11th. The show is part of the venue's new Sunday night stand-up comedy series, which continues this weekend with Kristen Key. The comedian may be familiar to many from her participation in the reality television talent show Last Comic Standing, where she finished in sixth place during the fourth season. When I spoke on the phone with Kristen yesterday, I asked her if she was more focused on winning or simply performing during her time on Last Comic Standing.
My goal was just to let people know who I was. And as I got to know the other comics, a lot of them were doing the same thing. It was just those of us who didn't have a lot of TV credits were like, I just want to get a couple jokes on TV. And then it turned out really lucky on my behalf that I just kept winning talent. Well, I kept going on the show. So worked out well for me.
And how has your life changed at all any since doing the show?
Absolutely. I lived in Amarillo, Texas until I did the show. And so it got me out of Texas. I got to go to California. Been living there ever since. So that's kind of a highlight for me.
And you actually got your start fairly young at 19 in Texas, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And why did you decide that that was something that you wanted to do? At 19, why did you decide, okay, I want to give comedy a shot?
At 19, I was in college to be a paramedic, and I don't think I was going to be a very good paramedic because I have problems with, like, dedication and punctuality. Plus, I think it's fun when people get hurt. But, no, I did an open mic night, and it was really, really fun, so quit college that week, quit my job, and just started doing it, thinking, oh, I'm going to be famous. And then that was hilarious. So 6 years to make it like $75 a week, and but it turned out really well.
Yeah, you're still plugging right along. So you're famous now.
I'm a celebrity.
Ah, a celebrity.
Known in small circles.
I like it. Well, in those small circles, how do people, what do they know about your style? What kind of style of comedy do you do?
No two shows are the same. Rapid fire, quick pace delivery, and I play the guitar at the end, so there will be music at the end.
Do you have a musical background? Is your family musical at all?
Well, it's funny because I grew up in, my dad's a minister, and I grew up in a church where we weren't
actually allowed to have instrumental music. So the fact that I play a guitar is terribly sinful. So take that, Dad.
Well, there you go. Now, something that's always been kind of interesting to me is it seems like there are not very many female comics. And is that, as someone who is a female and is a comic, is it more that there aren't a lot of women that are into this, or is it just it's more difficult for women, maybe?
I don't know. I mean, I've always been a woman, so I don't know what it's like to be a male.
Fair.
There are fewer women comics than male comics. I don't know why that is. It is a slightly more difficult lifestyle. You have to travel a lot and take a lot of ribbing. But, I can't tell you why there's fewer women.
Have you faced any difficulties as a woman in the comic world?
Well, other than my period. No, I don't know. It's, like I said, I've never been a man. I've heard from other people that they feel like women get treated unfairly. It's much harder for women to kind of climb the rung of the ladder. But in my experience, I feel like being a woman, you stand out because there are fewer women. So if you're a funny woman, you're going to go further because you've got something that men don't have, a vagina. Which I never talk about on stage, and I don't bring up the fact that I'm a woman a lot because it's pretty obvious.
Now, I'm sure over the years your comedy has changed. How does one craft their style of comedy? I mean, how do you improve? Because it's kind of a subjective thing, what's funny. I mean, some people are going to find you funny, some people just aren't.
Right. Well, you try to write jokes that are relatable to everyone, or at least the majority. And when I was younger, I only wrote jokes about things I knew about, so it was a much dirtier set, and it was because I was rebelling or whatever. But me and the comic I'm working with this week were just talking about that. Do you remember when you were younger? And I was like, oh, my God, my set was filthy. And then you get older and realize, oh, there's so much more I can write about. I could make that funny. Oh, I don't have to say that. But that is so crude. So it kind of gets to where you write smarter the older you get. But I think everybody starts out kind of writing a little dirty. Everybody has, like, pot and poop jokes.
That's...
But they evolve to be wonderful, clever pot and poop jokes.
There you go. Mature with age.
Like wine and cheese.
Like wine and cheese. Now, where would you say that you get your inspiration for your jokes? Or how is your writing process? I know a lot of people's are different. Do you just sort of sit down and decide that you're going to write jokes today? Or is it just kind of come to you? Or
a little bit of both. When they come to you, it's wonderful. And then when they don't, you try to sit down and write. And it's painful. Because the best jokes come to you when you're in a group of people. And you say it right then. You get laughter, and then you can tag it, and it becomes a full bit before you take it on stage. When you sit down with a pen and paper and write, you're in a room by yourself, and there's nothing funny about that. So you really have to let your imagination find something to grab onto and make it funny.
What other projects do you have coming up right now? I know next month you're going to appear on VH1's 100 Greatest Women in Music.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you got going on?
Yeah, I'm starting to record a new CD this year. It'll be my third. And I plan to release that at the end of the year. And there's other, trying to get a podcast up and running. Got the website going. Right now on the website, I'm doing a cartoon contest.
Oh, really?
So draw cartoons of me and win a prize. Get a new CD out and just spend a little bit more time in L.A. over the summer and get a few more TV credits.
And what is the prize for this contest?
Oh, you get a T-shirt and two CDs and a signed headshot.
Who doesn't love a T-shirt?
That's what I was saying.
So when you come to the UARC Bowl on Sunday, what can people expect from your show?
Hilarity. There will be midgets. There will be pyrotechnics. There will be jugglers. No, it'll be funny. I'll talk about me. I talk about my family. I talk about my past. I talk about the world that I live in right now. And I play some funny songs. And we all go home happy.
As long as everyone goes home happy.
That's my goal.
Kristen Key will perform at 7:30 Sunday night at the UARC Bowl in Fayetteville. Doors open at 7 and tickets are $7 for general admission and $5 for students. More information is available at uarkbowl.com.
This is Ozarks Large. I'm Goodman Strauss. Our resident math professor is back.
How's it going, Kyle?
It's going well. Ever since this new year began, we've been talking about the unusual qualities of the number 2012.
That's right.
Unusual qualities that mathematicians are more likely to find or know about, but it's interesting nonetheless. Are there any new ones?
Well, not – well, yes, sort of. But a listener, Ron Jones, suggests that we maybe pick up on 2012 as a theme throughout the year, or rather, as he puts it, a theme going till the end of time, which is
because
a little joke about the Mayan
calendar
thing.
And whatnot, yes.
But Felicia Blaine wrote in. She had also caught the thing about, you know, you could – the reverse of the square is the square of the reverse.
Right.
She points out that you can take 2012 and multiply by the reverse of its digits and get a palindrome. So 2012 times 2102.
Wait, let me do that here on my calculator. 2012 multiplied by 2102.
Right.
Equals 4229224.
Which is a cool thing. And it's the same property, basically, as we discussed last week, that there are no carries. But there's all kinds of neat stuff. That reminds me of something another little fun calculator thing. It's impressive for at least a second, mm-hmm. is if you take a bunch of ones, not too many, but you can go up to nine. Let's try on a smartphone, you can really have enough digits.
Well,
now.
I've got nine. I've got nine ones nine on my ones. Calculator.
And then multiply it by itself.
Equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Isn't that cool? And if it had been nine nines, it would have been 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4.
That's really neat.
And it's the same deal. It's, again, what we talked about last week. No carries. Huh. Let's see. We have a problem about the princess.
Ah, yes. Last time you were here, you said there were 17 rooms, 17
mm-hmm.
doors.
Mm-hmm. With a room behind each.
Right. And behind one of them was the princess.
Right.
Now, a prince could knock on the door, and if she was in that room, they were betrothed.
The rooms were, of course, attached. One
exactly.
The adjacent rooms were attached to one another.
But it was in a line and not a circle.
That's right.
And the
princess each day would have to change to an adjacent room.
And the thing about the adjacent doors is if she was in room 4 one day, she could go to 3 or 5.
That's right.
If she was in 7, she could go to 6 or 8. You could only go one room over.
That's right.
The prince, here's the caveat for the prince. He has a mere 30 attempts.
Right. Or it's...
Or he gets it. Not only do they not get married, bad stuff happens. Your question was... Is there a way to guarantee?
Which, of course, there is, or we wouldn't have a puzzle.
So I assume that, but I never – okay. So what is the answer? How can you and I guessed that the fact that it was in a line would kind of help you figure it out.
Yeah.
Because if you ever knew she was – if you could get her to 1 or 17, you knew she would have to come back.
That's the start of it. Anyone that's fooled around with this realizes that there is the hitch. Like suppose that she's at – on room 4 and he's knocking on 5. He's systematically going down the line and knocks on room 5.
On day 1, say he knocks on room 5 and she's in 4.
Right.
He doesn't have – I mean –
And then if he switches to 4, she could switch to 5, right?
And,
so she can get past him
right.
potentially. So the question is how to avoid that. Now, I suggest people that really want to follow this, you can try this out. It's on a podcast as well, so you can slow this mm-hmm. down and listen. But I made a little strip of paper. We've got 8 rooms here just for simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll catch – we'll catch it in, 12 turns.
Okay.
And you want to be the princess?
Sure.
You're so fetching. So
sure,
here
thank you.
You.
So you've just given me a dime.
Right. So you plop that down. And I'm going to do the same thing no matter what you do, so it doesn't really matter.
Okay. I am the princess, and this is day 1. I'm going to pick which room to be in.
Right. So
I'm going to say I want to be in room 5.
Okay. The whole idea here, first of all, is that, of course, the prince is going to chase the princess somehow around. We'll start on room 2.
Now, there of course is the 1 in 17 chance out of blind luck.
Sure.
Day 1.
Right.
But we're assuming that's not. So you're going to knock on.
In fact, I'll just tell you what I'm going to do.
Okay.
And you see if you can avoid me. I'm going to first knock on room door 2, then 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And I'll knock on 7 again, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. And let's just see if you can escape. So let's.
And for this example, let's reiterate, we've only got 8.
That's right.
Your puzzle was 17.
Yeah. In 30 days. We'll do 8 in 12 days.
Right.
We'll
so same principle here. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So day 1, I'm in room 5.
Okay.
And you knock on 2.
Right.
Next, I'm going to go to 6.
I move to 3.
All right. I move back to 5.
I move to 4.
I move to 6.
I move to 5.
I move to 7.
I'm chasing you to 6. You're at 8.
Oh, so if I go to room 6.
You
can't, wait.
You can't because I'm. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. You could go to room 6. Right. I'm just knocking.
Right.
Folks, we're sitting here with these coins on this strip of paper.
Right.
And we realize we made a mistake.
So I go to room 6.
Okay. I move to 7.
I go to 5.
I move to stay at 7, like I said I would.
All right. I go – now if I go to 6.
I would get you. So
let's, for argument's sake, say I go to 4.
I move to 6.
okay, so anytime I go back towards the higher number now, that's your next day.
So you're being chased
all
the way to one.
So I go three to two, and eventually I get to one.
And at that day, I'm knocking on room room three. So you have to move back to two, and I knock on two, and I got you.
There you go.
That's weird, isn't it? It actually always works, and there's a simple way to explain it, actually.
Okay.
So I think everybody certainly knows even and odd numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you were on the first day, you were knocking on room five. Mm-hmm. And, of course, one plus five is even.
Right.
Now, no matter what you did, it had to stay even because you were the day increases and you move one or up. The room number either goes up one or down one.
Right.
So if it was even, if the sum, one plus five, was even, the next day, what did you do? You went to four or six?
I think I went to four, then I started going back.
It doesn't really matter because on day two, say you went to four, then that two plus four is still even. And then the next day, no matter what you did, the total room day was even, and so on. Now, it could have been odd if you'd knocked on a different door on day one.
Or if I'd been behind a different door.
Right. But it's going to stay even or odd. You had no choice. And so in a nutshell, what's happening is the prince first – now, the prince started at room two on day one. Effectively, first he flushes out all the odd possibilities, chasing the princess to the higher numbers. And then he flushes out all the even possibilities. That's in a nutshell what happens.
So for the puzzle, when it was 17 doors, you would have gone to 16 and come back.
And that's it. Yeah, I would have erased all the odd possibilities, erased all the even possibilities.
So that's why it's important that you're saying 30.
Yes, that's right.
Because if you had said 5, no, there's no way to guarantee
that's
5.
That's where the numbers came from.
Right.
So, of course, 8, I went rooms 2 through 7, that's 6,
right.
And I did that twice, that's
okay.
12. Right.
Is there any law or –
I don't know. It's just cool.
I mean,
it's kind of neat. And I just thought it was kind of a neat application of even and odd and unexpected.
Well, fantastic news. The prince and the princess are together. So do we have anyone else to launch into Jeopardy?
Well, yeah. So this is a puzzle that's been circulating around. It's a it's another pursuit puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll just do another one or two of those.
Okay.
And the way it's often expressed is three spiders and a fly. But, you know, being a math professor, you know, we are cruel to our students. So,
are you? Okay.
Yeah. So let's, as chair, I speak with authority on that.
Oh, okay.
So, no, I'm kidding. We love our students. So,
I know.
But in any case, so we'll have three crazed professors chasing a student so that they can give him an F.
Okay.
A tetrahedron, do you know what that is? It's a triangle. You take a triangle and then you make a pyramid out of it.
Oh.
A triangular pyramid.
So a pyramid?
A triangular pyramid. A pyramid with a triangular base. And on this pyramid, or whatever, that's tetrahedron, the three professors and the student are walking along its edges. Now, if you think about it, it has six edges. There's the three from the original triangle and then the three uprights up to the top.
Mm-hmm.
But they're walking along the edges, and the professors move just a little bit faster than the student because they're older, I guess.
The student's on the cell phone.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. But the catch is that the student has ESP and knows exactly where the professors are and where they're coming from.
He has a cell phone that has their GPS.
There you go.
Okay.
How can the professors catch the student?
And you cannot leave this area.
No.
You're going to stay in this triangular pyramid area.
Now, there's another way to put it. Let's just draw a square.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, of course, has four corners. And then connect across the diagonals. From one corner to its diagonal opposite, and then the other corner to its diagonal opposite.
Right.
And the two diagonals would seem to cross, but that's not really a corner for, you know, you can't.
Right.
So basically now you can walk around the edges of the square, you can walk on one of the diagonals or one of the other diagonals. And
so your question is, how can you guarantee that the three professors eventually meet up with the student?
That's actually a picture of a tetrahedron in a funny way, but it's actually a lot easier to draw and a lot easier to see.
Professors are together?
No, they can go all over the place.
Okay.
As long as they stay on those edges.
And the student stays on the edges as well.
Yeah.
And there's a guaranteed way.
There is.
Okay.
Nice little puzzle.
Yeah. Where should people send their comments, answers, or 2012 trivial bits?
Or anything else.
Or anything else.
MathFactor@uark.edu, mathfactor.uark.edu. And we'll put some information on the website about this and a puzzle and some other stuff, too.
All right. Thanks, Haim.
Bye.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. And joining me now is Joel Bunch. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you.
And you are here to tell me about Artemis, their new vinyl album.
Yeah, this is a metal compilation called The Hills Have Amps. And it is a group of six different metal bands from the Fayetteville area.
And how did this idea come about?
This was an idea of Eric Jensen, who is the music director at Artemis, and he wanted to do a genre-specific compilation, and he had already done a punk compilation, so he decided he wanted to do a metal compilation. So he approached me and a good friend of mine, and we brainstormed, found six different bands, or more than six, but we found a group of bands we wanted to be on it. Then we began the process of getting art together, getting songs together, mixing it, and all that stuff.
And you were telling me before we got started that you are familiar with the metal scene. That's sort of how you got involved with this. How big is the metal scene here?
The metal scene in the Northwest Arkansas area is kind of strange. It grows and gets smaller. It's just like all the other music scenes in this area. It goes in cycles. And, right now there's probably, I would guess there's probably 30 to 50 bands, but they're not all active and they're not all playing shows. So that's a difficult question to ask. And a lot of these people are just projects. I've been doing a metal show on KXUA for about 6 years. So that's how I got involved.
And can you tell me about who are some of the bands on this album?
This album, we have, I'll just say them in order. We have Vor, Dead Eye Jack, The Lightbulb Detective Agency, Hymns, Ogham, and Dragon Sunday. And one thing I really, really enjoy about metal, and this compilation in particular, is how much ground you can cover musically. I mean, yes, these are all metal bands, but they play all different kind of styles and different kind of playing techniques and, like, vocal stuff. So it sounds really different from track to track. So I think that's really neat about a lot of variety.
And will we be able to hear some of these bands performing at the release party?
Yes, you can hear two of these bands are actually going to be performing at the release party. There will be Vor and Lightbulb Detective Agency, and there's another band who is not actually on here who will be playing called Potions. So the lineup is probably going to be Lightbulb Detective Agency, Potions, and then Vor.
All right. And the show is tonight at what time?
Show is 9 o'clock. It's probably when people are going to start showing up, but it'll probably be 10:30 when music starts.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's at Smoke and Barrel.
That's at Smoke and Barrel. 21 and up. $10 cover. Cover gets you a copy of the record, which does come with a download code. And the record, as I've shown you, is a multicolored splatter, which all that means is a lot of different colors. It's not just a black record. And the artwork, the back cover is done by Amjad Fowler, which is a photograph that he put together and took. And then the front is it's a painting that a friend of ours named Preston Graves did. And it's pretty gnarly looking. So really neat package. That's all $10, and it comes with a download code. And then you get to see a show as well.
Excellent. So for $10, I can get this vinyl album, I can get the download code, so I can get these songs on my computer, and I can see some live music.
Yep.
Excellent. And if we want more information on Artemis?
Artemis has a website, which is artemis.org, and there's also, on the back of the record, there's all that information as well as the KXUA website. This is kind of a joint thing between KXUA and Artemis. And KXUA, by the way, is the student-run radio station for the university.
All right. Is there anything else we should know?
I mean, for what it's worth, this is the culmination of 2 years of work, which I am proud of this. Also relieved that it's finally coming together. But really, really happy the way it's turned out, and excited to share it with others.
All right, Joel, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 27th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, born in Salzburg, Austria, 1756, who only lived for 35 years. But he started early, child prodigy from a family of musicians, toured all over Europe, wrote his first opera at the age of 11. He died at the age of 35 in mysterious circumstances. There's a popular image of him dying poor, miserable, working on a funeral requiem as he died. But overall, his final year was a productive one. He was living in Vienna. He was still getting commissions. He didn't have a lot of money that year, but then again, he rarely did. He and his wife, Constanze, never seemed able to live on what Mozart made. It was a busy year. In the first months of 1791, he wrote dance music for the winter balls at the court. He wrote the Piano Concerto No. 27. In the summer, a messenger came asking Mozart to write a requiem for his patron, Count Franz von Walsig, who had lost his wife, wanted to commission a requiem in her honor. Mozart was working on the opera La Clemenza di Tito to celebrate the coronation of Emperor Leopold as King of Bohemia, which premiered in early September. And 3 weeks later, his opera The Magic Flute opened in Vienna, which was a big hit. In October, he wrote the Clarinet Concerto in A, then a cantata for the Freemason Lodge, which he directed himself, November the 18th. Finally, he put all his energy toward the Requiem, but just after the performance of the cantata, he became extremely ill. He had a fever. His whole body was swollen. He continued writing the Requiem right up until he died, which was only 2 weeks after he became sick. And he died on December the 5th, 1791, was buried in a mass unmarked grave, which was a common practice for the middle class of Vienna. Nobody knows what his illness was. There are many theories about it: rheumatic fever, tuberculosis, syphilis, congestive heart failure, kidney disease, poisoning. But today is his birthday, 1756. Mozart, who said music in even the most terrible situations must never offend the ear, but always remain a source of pleasure. And it's the birthday of Lewis Carroll, born in Daresbury, England, 1832, Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, gifted at math, taught at Oxford, wrote poems and short stories, took photographs. And then one day in 1856, he took three little girls, Ina, Edith, and Alice, on a boating trip down the river and told them the story that became Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And a few years later, its sequel, Through the Looking Glass, and What Alice Found There. Lewis Carroll, whom Mark Twain called the stillest and shyest full-grown man I have ever met. Here's a poem for today by Kay Ryan, entitled Don't Look Back. This is not a problem for the necklace. Fish cannot recklessly swivel their heads to check on their fry. No one expects this. They are torpedoes of disinterest, compact capsules that rely on the odds for survival, unfollowed by the exact and modest number of goslings the S-necked goose is, who, if she looks back, acknowledges losses, and if she does not, also loses. Don't Look Back by Kay Ryan. From Say Uncle, published by Grove Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Mitch McGrahada.
Have a great Friday.